The next case for argument is 21-1903, Nike v. Adidas. Mr. Harris, whenever you're ready, I think we're ready to begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. The board committed a number of errors that warrant reversal, including two legal errors that we plan to focus on this morning. First, the board legally erred when it relieved Adidas, an active petitioner, of the burden of persuasion. Now, to frame this issue, we don't think there's any dispute that the law is settled that a petitioner bears the burden of persuasion for patentability propositions that it itself raises. The question for today...
And that is Bosch?
That's Bosch, yeah. The question for today is if the board, sua sponte, raises an unpatentability proposition, which it's allowed to do, that's Nike 2, does that remove the burden of persuasion from an active petitioner like Adidas?
Well, let me ask you, okay, so we're putting things into buckets here. So let me look at it the other way. Would you agree there's no dispute that if the petitioner is dropped out, there's no burden on the petitioner, the board does what it did here?
Yeah, Your Honor, certainly we acknowledge there are instances where the adversarial process that Congress envisioned for IPRs breaks down. And I think the Supreme Court has identified one of those instances is
okay.
Where
so we agree with that.
All yeah, right. Yeah. That's so, not the issue.
And what about if the petitioner kind of remains in the case, hasn't dropped out of the case, but they don't oppose the amendment at all? You would agree that's the same thing.
Again, yeah, that's not the case before us today. That may be
well,
an instance
that.
where. The adversarial process that Congress intended is no longer in place.
So the slice we're looking at here is the circumstance in which there's still a petitioner in the case. The petitioner has opposed the motion to amend, and it's just a matter of this last ground. You're suggesting that there's no dispute. We can ask the other side about the stuff that it put forward. It's got the burden of persuasion on that. It's just a matter of this other limited category, correct?
We see that as the dispute, the question for today, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question? What if we think, no matter who has the burden here, well, let's say flip this way. What if you're right and Adidas had the burden here, but they satisfied it? Like after the board presented, here's a potential ground, and we said, hey, you've got to let the parties comment on that, and then Adidas went ahead and commented on it, presented evidence, presented argument, and that was enough to satisfy their burden of proof, then why do we even need to address the question you're asking? Is you're asking us to make sure that they had the burden and, you know, no matter what, they satisfied. So why wouldn't anything be harmless here?
Your Honor, respectfully, because that's not what the board did. We don't know what that final written decision would have looked like if the board had conducted that analysis with the burden on Adidas.
But if the board did write a decision that in fact did summarize all of the petitioner's arguments and the patent owner's arguments, and then ultimately agreed with the petitioner's arguments and then rejected the patent owner's arguments and explained its reasons why, and then we were to look at such a board decision and conclude that the board was in fact matching up its findings with the very arguments that the petitioner itself raised, then the question still stands, would it make a difference? I guess to follow up on Judge Stoll's question, let's treat it as a hypothetical. What if that is the nature of the board's decision? Then would you agree that this whole burden assignment question is not relevant to resolving the case if that's the way the board decision could be read, i.e. it in fact followed and adopted the very arguments the petitioner made?
So in this hypothetical, the board is determining that the petitioner came forward with evidence that would have satisfied a burden of persuasion if the burden was on that petitioner. That's obviously not the case before us in that hypothetical. I don't know how that would come out, but I think that generally speaking, it still matters where the burden lies for an adversarial proceeding like this one. And here's why, Your Honor. If the burden is on the petitioner, the active petitioner, which is where we think it should be because that petitioner is best positioned and incentivized to come forward with evidence supporting an unpatentability proposition, even if it's one that the board raises, because the petitioner is ultimately going to be bearing the burden of estoppel if that proposition is unsuccessful. In this case, for instance, the proposition that the board sua sponte raised in the previous Nike 2 case was whether skipping stitches to form apertures was a well-known technique to a skilled artisan. On remand, Adidas didn't come forward with any additional evidence, such as expert opinions, expert testimony on what a skilled artisan would think about skipping stitches or whether that would be well known to a skilled artisan. As a result, they were left with the attorney argument.
Well, what was wrong with just doing the quotes from the Spencer textbook itself, which is in fact what the board did when it initially did the analysis?
Yeah, what's wrong with that is what the board in fact did was said, they looked at Adidas's attorney argument, no expert opinion, no other evidence. They looked at Adidas's attorney argument. Adidas's attorneys are not skilled artisans.
I just want to stop you for a second because it feels like your response is sort of sliding into a different zone, which is trying to make the case for why the ground of rejection is flawed on an evidentiary way. And really the argument that I'm trying to understand is why does the burden assignment question even matter if Adidas in its remand response said the identical thing that the board ultimately found both in its second final written decision and then the third final written decision up on appeal. I don't understand why it makes any difference.
And I agree with you. I was sliding into the substantial evidence.
So let's stay with my question.
But I think the answer to your question is by removing the burden from Adidas, this active petitioner, the board converted or changed this proceeding from an adversarial proceeding to more of an examination proceeding, which resulted in the substantial burden error, which is a different
burden. Removed. Your view is it your view? I'm just trying to make sure I understand. I feel like maybe your view is that because the board is the one that initially identified these particular grounds, that means the petitioner automatically didn't satisfy their burden of proof.
Well, the petitioner didn't raise that unpatentability proposition.
So that's true. But that ship has sailed. In Nike 2, this court held that the board could sua sponte raise those grounds, but had to give the parties notice and comment, ability to comment, respond. So what if on remand, the petitioner presents what would otherwise be, setting the procedural history aside, what would have otherwise been a case where they satisfied their burden of proof.
Yes, and we agree with that. If the board sua sponte raises an unpatentability proposition, it must give the parties notice and opportunity to respond, including the active petitioner. And at that point, the petitioner can come forward with additional evidence.
Why do they have to have additional evidence? What is your ground for that? Why do they have to have additional evidence? As Judge Chen said, why isn't it enough that they satisfy their burden of proof? It might be that they're parroting what the board said, but they're satisfying their burden of proof by citing the reference itself.
Understood, Your Honor. And I'm not suggesting that they must absolutely come forward with new evidence. My point is that they have the opportunity to do that. And in this adversarial proceeding that Congress envisioned, they're best incentivized to come forward with evidence. And they may not need to do that in all instances, but there may be instances where the board raises sua sponte, a proposition of unpatentability, and it makes sense for the petitioner to come forward with additional evidence to support that proposition.
Right, but they're not required.
They're not required.
So the only
to,
question yeah. So you agree that it doesn't matter that the board raised the issue, that's not going to impair, that itself is not going to impact the petitioners, whether they've satisfied the burden of proof.
That's correct, yeah. Our position is that regardless of whether the board raises, sua sponte raises the proposition, the burden remains on an active petitioner.
I'm enlightened in this regard by the rulemaking proceeding that they adopted, which obviously doesn't apply to this case, but I think it's a very close cousin. And I assume that it may be that the board, we didn't speak to this explicitly in Nike, but once you allow, as we clearly, that ship, as Judge Stoll said, that ship has sailed, the board to sua sponte come up with its own grounds that have not been put forward by the petitioner, even where he's opposing the motion to amend, that takes this out of the sort of adversarial realm. So maybe they thought it made more sense. I mean, are there any other areas of law where a third party comes up with a ground and then the other side has the burden of persuasion for that ground? I mean, if the board's allowed to raise this, then presumably it can go forward, and we said, even when the petitioner is gone. So I think logic, at least, and rules of law seem to, at least in my mind, further the board's realizing this has to be a different camp. And that's why it doesn't make sense to particularly ascribe a burden of persuasion here.
Your Honor, the Patent Office's subsequent rulemaking around this issue, what we think is really interesting, the rule that the office has since entered does not say that the burden of persuasion is no longer on the petitioner, an active petitioner, if the board sua sponte raises an unpatentability proposition. The office could have done that. I mean, that was obviously an issue at the time, and they chose not to include that language.
Well, I'm going to ask them about that too, yeah. Because I think I don't accept that necessarily as correct, but we'll see what they say about that. I mean, they do have language there that says irrespective of what the provisions are for the burden, the board can do this. So that suggests that those burdens and A and B or whatever it is in the rule don't apply to this circumstance. But we'll ask them if their rule, not mine.
Here's another hypothetical. What if the board here had decided that the burden of persuasion really should be on Adidas? How would this board decision have looked different substantively?
I think it would have looked different because the decision would have been Adidas has only provided attorney argument on what a skilled artisan would think or how a skilled artisan would interpret what the parties disputed was disclosed in Spencer. And that attorney argument alone isn't enough to overcome or to satisfy the burden of persuasion that should have properly been on Adidas.
But isn't the answer to that informed by, I mean, you would acknowledge, would you not, that the patent owner has a burden of production, arguably, in these circumstances, right? I mean, the board has come up with something. Doesn't that what you think the petitioner has to come forward with rely on how much the patent owner has to say?
Well, the patent owner comes forward with an amended or proposed substitute claims and has to satisfy a certain...
Right, but the board came up here and identified for itself Spencer and gave some argument as to the rationale for why Spencer applies here and is very relevant and persuasive. Doesn't the patent owner, in order to ascertain how much more the petitioner needs to come forward with, isn't that, as a practical matter, contingent on what the patent owner has to say?
Well, if the burden is on, respectfully, Your Honor, if the burden's on the petitioner and the petitioner hasn't come forward with any evidence, for instance, in this case, to support or establish how a skilled artisan would understand Spencer.
So your answer is the patent owner didn't have to say anything on remand and case over because the petitioner hasn't come up with any expert testimony.
Well, or some type of evidence. It could have been expert testimony, some type of evidence to show how a skilled artisan would understand Spencer and whether a skilled artisan would understand Spencer to establish that skipping stitches to form apertures was not only known, a well-known technique.
You would acknowledge that petitioners aren't required to have expert testimony
Agreed.
In an IPR.
And that if the references are self-evident enough, then that's good enough for the board to make fact findings on what the reference teaches.
Yeah, we certainly agree that there's no obligation to have expert opinion, expert testimony. I'm just using that as an example. But quickly, I would like to just address the second legal issue, which is the same legal issue that this court found the board committed in the first remand, and that is the APA violation. In the first remand, the court found that the board violated the APA's requirements of notice and opportunity to respond because, quote, the board did not provide Nike of, quote, the specific portions of Spencer that the board might rely on in its decision. At that time, we were debating whether Spencer disclosed or taught skipping stitches to form apertures was a well-known technique. So we debated that. The parties debated that on remand. And that was the only portion of Spencer. The board identified a couple pages of Spencer for that proposition. That's the only thing we debated on remand. In the board's final written decision, the board relied on previously unidentified portions of Spencer, pages 113 and 194, for the proposition that a skilled artisan would have been motivated to combine Spencer with the other three references, Nishida, Schussler 1, and Schussler 2, because Spencer taught a desire to minimize waste. It was the first time that the board had raised that argument. Now, Adidas is going to say, oh, well, we raised that argument in our remand briefing. They didn't cite those pages of Spencer. The first time those pages in Spencer were cited for the board's support for the board's proposition were in the final written decision. And there's an inherent inconsistency in Adidas's argument. On one hand, they're saying, we didn't raise it, so we don't bear the burden.
What if we were to look at that motivation basis, as a backup basis? Because there was the primary basis for combining Spencer with the other references, and that was that it was a known way of creating apertures in this kind of material, and there was just a finite number of ways to create these kinds of apertures, so it'd be obvious to use any one of them, including the way that's taught by Spencer. That's the primary basis that the board relied upon. And then there was a backup one, which was this idea of limiting the amount of waste. So even if you are right that there's some possible defect, procedural defect, in that articulation of the motivation, there's nevertheless the primary one that you've got to get over.
So, Your Honor, respectfully, this is that page, the last paragraph of the board's final written decision, Appendix 36, spans over to Appendix page 37. And we respectfully disagree with that interpretation of that paragraph. The board did not say we have a primary motivation to combine all four references and we have a secondary motivation to combine all four references. Instead, what the board said in the first portion of that paragraph is that because, in the board's opinion, skipping stitches to form apertures was a well-known technique, a skilled artisan would have used that technique in Nishida. And then in the next sentence, which spans onto Appendix page 37 of the decision, the board went on to say, and because all four of these references are motivated by or teach minimizing waste, the skilled artisan would have been motivated to combine all four references to get to the ultimate unpatentability proposition. Thank you, Your Honor.
Will we start some rebuttal?
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is time being split here? On
the other side? Yes.
Sorry.
And oddly, we're done here for now. The office has only reserved 3 minutes for itself and 12 minutes for the other side, and that may be a little skewed given the kind of questions we may have. So that may need to be adjusted.
Certainly, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Michael Morlock for Apelli Adidas AG, and I will start right where Nike left off on the issue of notice. Specifically,
I actually want to ask you a question. I want to know if you know in an adversarial process where there's two parties that are actively participating, are you aware of any circumstances in which there's no burden of proof provided to either party or anybody?
I am not aware of such a proceeding, Your Honor. But in this instance, I don't think the ultimate, in these specific facts, it makes a difference. Because regardless of where the burden would lie here, the board fully analyzed Adidas' arguments, fully analyzed Nike's arguments, and sided with Adidas. So regardless of where the burden would lie, the ultimate outcome would be the same. It would just be harmless error if the burden were to be placed somewhere else.
Well, just following up on Judge Stoll's question, another way to look at it is, I guess, the extent to which we have proceedings where the third party gets to raise contentions not made by the person who ultimately may have the burden of persuasion, and how it works, how the burden allocation works in that circumstance, which is, as I said, something maybe the PTO is prepared to answer. Do you have any information, do you have any knowledge of the regulations which don't apply to this case, but obviously are out there?
I do not, Your Honor.
Okay, and do you, I guess the second part of that question is, do you happen to know, and we'll ask the PTO, following up on Judge Chen's question on the other earlier case, is this a one-off? In other words, we've got the regulations that went into effect sometime shortly after this. They didn't affect Hunting Titan. And do you know whether there are other cases that will require the board to reliance on this board decision as opposed to the regulatory framework?
Your Honor, I am not aware of others. My suspicion is that this is a bit of a spotted cow, in that we've got amended claims and a ground of rejection raised sua sponte. So I think it's unlikely there are others,
well,
but
again,
I don't know.
I'd urge you to sort of make sure the board has enough time to, the PTO has enough time to answer. But let me ask you about the arguments your friend was making. This goes to, I guess you're saying, harmless error. This doesn't matter. And so what do you say to your friend's argument about your not having put forth enough evidence so that you could even arguably say that you met the burden of persuasion?
That's incorrect, Your Honor. Adidas presented detailed citations to record evidence, both from the Nishida prior art reference that had already been considered and had already been acknowledged to disclose every element of the claims, including apertures for receiving laces, just not disclosing specifically how those apertures were formed.
So didn't you need expert testimony to put that all together in order to satisfy, arguably, a burden of persuasion?
No, Your Honor, because it's clear from the references. It's just common sense looking at Spencer's specific disclosure of forming an aperture using an open work structure. That's appendix site 799. And then the very next page on appendix site 800 explaining that, I believe the exact words were, empty needles could be used to form an open work structure. An empty needle, I mean, that's the same as omitting a stitch. And that's common sense. That's not something that an expert has to articulate in order to carry the burden.
What does empty needle mean? Does empty needle mean that there is an attempt at a stitch being made, but there's no yarn attached to the needle, and so therefore it's an attempt at making a stitch, but it actually no stitch is being made?
Yes, and Your Honor, we're talking about knitting, and with knitting, if there is an empty needle, I mean, there is no thread, there is no stitch being made, so it's exactly omitting stitches, just without using the ipsis verbis test for omitting stitches.
I don't recall there being any dispute about that factually. Am I correct? That there was agreement that an empty needle means omitting a stitch?
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that's exactly what is expressly described in the reference and not disputed.
I'm going to guess Nike is going to come up and say otherwise.
Possibly, yes, Your Honor. With respect to the notice issue, just wanted to quickly highlight there are two specific grounds for motivations to combine identified in Adidas's briefing and also relied upon by the board. The first, this is Adidas's brief below in appendix 2619 through 2620, Adidas described that omitting stitches was a well-known technique and that it was simple substitution of one well-known technique for what a Nike's expert had testified occurred in Nishida, which was cutting a hole. That's something Nike can't argue that it didn't have notice of because it was addressed in detail in the prior remand proceeding. It's exactly what the board found. Adidas then raised what it described as an additional motivation to combine, and that was minimizing waste. And as Nike's counsel acknowledged, they had full notice of that through Adidas's briefing. Now, Nike's argument seems to be what I heard when counsel was here speaking before, is the two CEG sites, and those were cited for the first time in the board's final written decision. But Nike's complaint with that is based on a misreading of what this court's decision in Nike 2 said. There, the direct quote is that the board had to give notice of the issue and opportunity for the parties to respond before issuing a final written decision. That's at page 51 of Nike 2. And the board identified, or this court identified specific examples of what would meet that notice. It wasn't requiring the board to identify every pen site on which it might rely. It was simply, inform the parties that the board intended to rely on Spencer for disclosing the disputed limitation of substitute claim 49 and request supplemental briefing from the parties regarding its proposed ground for unpatentability. That's page 54 of Nike 2. That's exactly what the board did here. So,
you want to turn to the patent office? Maybe we should turn to talking to the representative of the PTO, simply because it seems like one of the big issues here is the burden of persuasion.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Since we've already had a lot of chatter about this burden of persuasion, let me start off by asking you what I think is a pretty compelling question in terms of the import of this case. Let's turn to the regulations. Is it clear to you? Do you have a view? Is the PTO's analysis saying, irrespective of the burden of persuasion being on the petitioner, the board can raise this? Does that answer the question of whether or not the burden of persuasion would apply in this circumstance or not?
The regulation does not speak to that question. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did you say I didn't hear you.
Yes, the regulation does not speak to that precise question. This case, of course, as we all know, preceded the promulgation of that regulation.
So why are you saying there's this gap in your new regulation as to the burden assignment question for when the board, sua sponte, raises an unpatentability issue itself recognizes?
Personally, I do not know why that gap was left. The agency was...
You're familiar with Aqua Products, the en-banc decision.
Sure.
Where I believe a majority of the court there said that even though the 316E statutory provision is ambiguous, what happened here in putting the burden on the patent owner for that motion to amend was procedurally improper because there was no regulation that actually was put in place, and a board decision was not going to do it. So now here we are again with a motion to amend,
and we have a particular situation where you have written a brand new regulation, but the regulation doesn't speak to the burden assignment question?
A couple of observations. First, it seems to me that when the agency promulgated the regulation, it was concerned with the issue of sua sponte, the board's ability to raise sua sponte grounds of unpatentability and situations in which that would be proper. And so, for one thing, it may just be that that was more of the focus of that regulation than about burdens.
Can you defend this burden assignment matter under the rationale that collectively our Aqua Products opinions stated?
Two things. Number one, Aqua Products itself acknowledged that there are situations in which a petitioner may drop out of the case. And so in that situation, the board would be free to raise grounds of unpatentability and to explore those. And in a situation like this, that's more or less what we have. Adidas, at least with respect to this particular sua sponte ground, did not present that to the board, and so we're left.
But Adidas wasn't just sitting on its hands and keeping its mouth shut. It actively got involved in embracing what the board said sua sponte. So we do have an officially, formally opposed motion to amend, which is very unlike the peculiar circumstance we identified in Aqua Products.
I would suggest that it's not so different, because at the end of the day, it is the board and not the private parties who are responsible for getting the question of patentability correct. And so even if you have a petitioner who is still present, if the petitioner doesn't present a ground that the board finds salient, the board still has an obligation to pursue it.
But then the petitioner piggybacks on it and then actually engages completely.
Practically speaking, I think it would be difficult if we think about how that would play out. And so let's say, for instance, the board says, okay, we've come up with a potential ground of unpatentability, and it's sort of the skeleton theory based on several references. And so now we're going to kind of push it back to the petitioner to tell us what the petitioner thinks. It seems like sort of an odd way to do to assign burdens for the
Your view is that once the board raises the ground, it can't put the burden of proof on the petitioner. That's impracticable?
I'm not saying that there can never be a situation in which that might happen, but I can see how that would be.
The board said that, well, we look at this reference, it's of record, and it looks like when you combine it with the other prior, it makes a pretty good obviousness case. And then the petitioner ran with that, and the patent owner responded to it. I mean, why is it impractical or it couldn't work where the petitioner is actually actively participating?
Even though in the parties, including the petitioner, did brief it, at the end of the day, it was still the board's job to decide.
Well, I think the confusion here is we're talking about slicing and dicing pretty thinly, and different hypotheticals. I agree with Judge Stoll's hypothetical in that circumstance, which is counting on the petitioner to piggyback and say, we're going to follow up with the board and we're going to have an opportunity to put on more evidence. One, I'm not sure in every circumstance they would have that opportunity necessarily. Here it came up on a remand. Secondly, what if the petitioner just goes to sleep at the switch? I mean, what if in the interim they've reached a settlement? What if their client has said, I'm so sick of this case, I'm not spending one more dime on it? I mean, there can be hypothetical circumstances in which the board comes up with stuff that it finds, by definition, are readily identifiable and persuasive. And if the burden of persuasion under the rules, you say it's not clear. So automatically, whatever the board says doesn't matter, because if the petitioner doesn't raise it in a persuasive way, it's done, right?
Well, even if the petitioner doesn't raise it in a persuasive way, the board still could...
Well, not if they have the burden, not if the petitioner has the burden of persuasion, and you're saying that the rule doesn't answer that question. We have this board opinion here that seems to answer the question, but I'm just puzzled why the rule didn't... I mean, the rule, I think my reading of the rule, speaking only for myself, does suggest that that's what's going on here because they're taking it out of the adversarial process. But if your view is that it's not really answered by this rule, I'm not sure what to do in the absence of relying on a rule.
I see the red light is on. If
I
could just
ask you another question too, answer
sure.
The question, and I have a question. So
I think one way the court can handle this is that if the court believes that on the merits it wouldn't make a difference if claim 49 is unpatentable regardless of who or the burden, if anybody in this case, then this issue doesn't even need to be decided to begin with, and perhaps it's better to wait to cross the bridge with a case that followed came after the regulation was promulated.
But you told us the regulation doesn't answer the question, so then we're left in our situation where the board's going to come in, the PTO's going to come in and say, well, this is our interpretation of the regulation. I'm just wondering what you're hypothesizing here as being the future that we're going to meet.
I don't know, but what I do know is that this case came well before the regulation, and this does appear to be a one-off, a pretty unique case. And so,
just getting back to what Judge Prost said, this relevant provision in this new reg leads off with irrespective of paragraphs D1 and D2 of this section. And so, I mean, one could possibly infer that what this provision is trying to say is, forget about all these burden assignment things we just said in D1, D2. There are going to be instances where the board can, in the interest of justice, swoop in and do its own thing if it sees a problem with a proposed substitute claim, and give each side an opportunity to respond. But that seems to just wipe away any matters of assigning burdens of proof to either the petitioner or the patent owner. That's but you're saying that's not how I should read this provision?
I
should instead read this provision as just saying it's completely silent on the question of who's got the burden.
Well, clearly it doesn't verbatim talk about burdens, but I believe that the way that you read that, Judge Chen, would certainly be a plausible way to read it.
I'm sorry, I didn't know.
It would be a plausible way to read it, yes.
You mean, so you're amending your answer to my first question?
Yes, I think
your brief doesn't say anything about it other than a footnote saying it didn't apply here because it's not time. So I guess I want what you're saying here is pretty significant to me. So I guess I'd like to be clear on what it is you're saying.
In the situation where the board has sua sponte raised a patentability ground, this really seems like really logically the only way it could come out, and I think the way that Judge Chen read that regulation very well comports with logically what the answer should be.
So just to be clear, you're saying that the PTO's position is that the regulation addresses the issue we have before us today, and it says that nobody has the burden of proof. Just to be clear.
I think it can reasonably be read to say that, yes.
Okay, my question to you is, are you aware of any circumstance in which there are two adversaries taking contrary positions on an issue, and there's a decision maker, and nobody has the burden of proof?
I'm not aware of any other agency adjudication in which I can think of.
Agency or court or anything.
I certainly can go look, and if I find anything relevant, I'd be happy to file something.
In an inter partes reexamination, can the board, on an appeal from, say, an examiner rejection, issue a new ground of rejection?
I'm sorry, in an ex parte reexamination?
No, inter partes reexamination.
In inter partes reexamination, the board can issue a new ground of rejection, I believe so.
Is that a reg or somewhere in the MPEP, or is that just practice?
There is a regulation that covers that about what the board must do to give proper notice to the parties and an opportunity to respond. And that would either be through reopening prosecution or requesting rehearing.
Do you think that's analogous to these IPR situations where...
It's not completely analogous because in an inter partes re-examination, you still have the examiner involved who may be doing searches, may be gathering evidence before the board becomes involved in the case. And in an IPR, you have the board sitting there in the first, really in the only instance, assessing the record, what's in the record.
But I guess in an inter partes re-exam, we have the board issuing this rejection based on its own analysis of the record. And of course, it has to establish its findings by preponderance of the evidence, but it's not relying on any party to meet a particular burden before it comes out of the box and issues a new ground of rejection. Is that right?
I think that's fair to say.
Are you aware, I don't know exactly, when did the regulation go into effect?
It was January of 2021, I believe.
So we're a year and a half out. Are you aware of any instances, any cases in which this regulation has been relied on by the Patent Office? And are you aware whether any of those cases involve the allocation of the burden?
I am not aware of any at this point. If the court would like me to follow up with, just to make sure any question answers any of these questions, I'm happy to double check, but I'm pretty confident that...
Okay, thank you. But just so I understand, are you saying that in the past year you're unaware of the board in an IPR doing this sua sponte thing where it identified a new possible ground of unpatentability?
I cannot think of any. There are obviously many IPRs percolating in the agency, but I don't think we've seen any so far.
Do you have any idea when the board does sua sponte identify and raise a new unpatentability issue? Does it always do like a full dress analysis like it did here, which is essentially a new ground of rejection? Or could it be something much more limited? Like if we were to take the facts of this case, the board doing nothing more than saying, oh, I see there's a textbook called Spencer in this record, and it looks like there's something interesting in there about open work structures. Maybe the parties could do a briefing on that and the relevance to the patentability claim, period. Do you know if the board ever does something in that kind of a limited form, or is it always the full dress rejection?
I think that I don't know off the top of my head. My sense is that the board at the end of the day is going, it typically likes to get a full briefing from the parties, and so the board might spell something out fully in the first instance, but
well,
it certainly
did that here. I'm just trying to figure out if that's the way it's going to go about it, just to give everybody full awareness of what the board is thinking about how the claim might be unpatentable, so that both parties will know going in on further briefing exactly what it is they need to be directed to.
Well, certainly from a notice and opportunity to respond perspective, I agree that the board would be good to give parties as much detail to go on as possible.
Can I just follow up? I think this is maybe a variation or a flip side of what Judge Stoll was asking about, which is, the board and its regulation goes to some length, presumably because this is not normal. This is not part of the adversarial process of explaining why, in its view, the board has the right to come up with its own references. So are you aware of a circumstance in which the board, some third party has done this, or some adjudicatory party has done this and has placed the burden on the moving party? It's not the moving party who's come up with this argument, it's the board. I mean, this isn't normal, right? I mean, that's why the board in its regulation goes to lengths to say this is in the interest in justice to protect the integrity of the patent system, yada-da-da-da. Are you aware of a circumstance in which the third party comes up with something and the moving party therefore has the petition nonetheless to come up with, have the burden of persuasion, notwithstanding that it was not raised by that party?
I'm not.
Thank you. We'll give you, in order to try to even the time, we've spent a lot of time, so we'll give you 5 minutes of rebuttal if you need it. Or if there are further questions, yeah. Even more than that. But
thank you.
Let's see how it goes.
Okay, thanks. And I just have a couple points. So first, there's been a lot of talk today about a lot of different hypotheticals. We now know the USPTO's position that the facts of our case, the current regulations do not cover that, the dispute that's before us today. In our case, we have an active petitioner that was opposing the amended claims every step of the way. The best way to protect the integrity of the patent system in an adversarial process like this is to keep the burden on the petitioner. If the board raises sua sponte something, some unpatentability proposition that the petitioner missed, the petitioner gets a second bite at the apple. They might have multiple bites at the apple. And at the end of that, if the petitioner, who's best incentivized to come forward with the best evidence and arguments, still can't meet that burden of persuasion, it can't be said that the patent office wasn't protected, or the patent system, the integrity of the patent system wasn't protected. And Your Honors, we would submit that this case shows exactly why the burden should be on the petitioner. Our friends at Adidas stood up here and said, not once, but twice. It's common sense. Read the board's opinion. Nowhere in that opinion does the board say, it's just common sense. But now Adidas's argument is it's common sense. Everybody knew. Common sense. Everybody knew. Skipping stitches, deformed apertures, well-known technique. Common sense. The board doesn't say it. Nowhere in the record is there any evidence to support that it's common sense. Judge Chin, you're asking our friends at Adidas, what does empty needle mean? Well, our friends at Adidas, they're not skilled artisans. I'm not a skilled artisan. The board that we had in this case, the panel, they weren't skilled artisans. Nowhere in that record evidence is there any explanation of what empty needle means. Spencer doesn't describe what an empty needle is. Spencer says you can use empty needles.
Don't we have to give substantial evidence review to that fact finding by the board in interpreting the meaning of empty needles in Spencer?
That is a substantial evidence review, but Henry Zirko says that the board can't rely merely on common sense. There has to be some record evidence to support that. And I would submit that's not here. The board didn't even attempt to make that argument. It's nowhere in the decision. And that's why the board should have put the burden on petitioner. And if the board had done that, we submit that this
but
decision
would have
been much
different.
But
you're seeking a remand, right? Obviously.
Obviously.
Like the night of the living dead.
This patent does expire in a few years.
It does?
Yes. Yeah. Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've been both sides and the case is taken.